Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Social media is both a boon and a curse. It has opened the floodgates to all kinds of communication and entertainment, but it has taken a toll on our democracy, and it has had an impact on some who overuse it. That is especially true for young people. In 2023, the U.S. Surgeon General reported that up to 95% of young people between 13 and 17 use social media every day, and over a third are using it almost constantly. Already at risk for depression and anxiety, social media seems to increase those conditions if young people spend more than 3 hours per day on those platforms, and that is why at least 9 states have passed laws or are thinking of passing laws requiring some restrictions for young people and their use of social media, and North Carolina could be next. There is a new bill in the House that would ban social media companies from allowing anyone 13 years old or younger from opening an account. It would also require parental consent for accounts belonging to 14 and 15-year-olds. Although there are many questions about how to enforce such requirements, the bill proposes fines as high as $50,000 for platforms that violate the restrictions. This also raises free speech questions. Some say these restrictions would violate the First Amendment. This hour, a closer look at what House Bill 301 would do and at the impact of social media on the young. Adam Wagner is a reporter for NC Newsroom. That's a journalism collaboration among public radio stations throughout the state, including WFAE, aimed at expanding coverage of state government. He is here along with Michael Lynn Jensen, an associate professor of psychology at UNC Greensboro, who focuses on mobile communication technologies to better understand their role in adolescent mental health and substance abuse. And Renee Thompson is with us. She's executive director of Social Light Stars, which seeks to educate and bring awareness to the effects of social media trauma. Thank you all for being here. Good morning and welcome.
Morning.
So, Adam, I'm gonna begin with you. Lawmakers in the State House have introduced what I said was HB 301, House Bill 301, the Social Media Protections for Minors Act, which would place these restrictions and more that I just mentioned. Where is the thrust for this bill coming from?
Yeah, the biggest thing, like you mentioned, is just keeping kids, younger kids, from having these social media accounts at all. And it's coming from Representative Jeff Zenger. He's a Republican from Louisville. He said he raised 4 kids. He fought about social media with them, and he wants to be able to help parents out that are in similar spots. So
I was going to hear from Jeff Zenger a little later in the program. We'll hear from him now since you referenced his comment, because he's one of the primary sponsors of this bill, and he does, as you mentioned, have personal reasons for sponsoring the bill.
As a parent who has fought the battle of screen time with 4 kids who are now all in their 20s, it is a raging battle. And so the idea was to put something up that would be a backstop for parents so that they could help regulate this and help kind of stand with this battle.
So does this bill have bipartisan support, or is it just coming from Mr. Zenger?
Oh, it definitely has bipartisan support. There's a lot of energy and concern basically around social media and around phones right now. We heard the governor talk about phones in schools earlier this year. We've seen legislators on both sides of the aisle express concern about access to these websites.
I want to talk, Michael, about this panic, if that's what it is, about social media and the use of it. As a child growing up, I'm a little older than everybody on this panel combined, but as a child growing up, everybody was talking about, they were worrying about kids spending too much time with the boob tube. And now kids are spending a lot of time on other kinds of screens other than television. But we survived. How is this different, Michael Lynn?
Yeah, so you're exactly right that this is not the first time that parents and the public and legislators have gotten worked up and freaked out about a new technology that kids are especially drawn to. So we've seen this with video games before this. We saw it with television before that. Before that, we saw it with radio and dime store novels. And so in general, older folks like us tend to harken back to the way we were raised and what we were exposed to as some sort of a standard for how we want to raise our kids. And I think it's scary when new things come online that are unknown, especially when they're really exciting to young people. And I will say, adolescents tend to be the earliest and the most enthusiastic adopters of any of these novel technologies. They're excited about new stuff and they don't have this reticence to try new things. And so, yeah, this isn't the first time this has happened. Is it different was the second part of your question.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, I think this kind of moral panic around social media shows a lot of kind of historical similarities to what we saw with those prior technology panics in particular. The closest parallel would be video games. And I think in some ways that has calmed down. In fact, video games are like explicitly excluded from this bill, which is interesting. And so I don't know that it is different. I think there are some things about social media. We have data now to suggest that mental health is declining among adolescents and emerging adults. And so I think that's one of the things that makes this feel particularly salient to lawmakers and to parents, that if this could be a tool to improve mental health, it feels very activating.
But I want to follow up on something that you told NPR, and I'm not sure exactly when you spoke with them, so maybe your mind has changed or maybe new data has come in. You said, if I'm not misquoting you, that we don't know at all that social media in general causes mental health harms or that certain platforms are more harmful, only that some types of engagement can be harmful.
I did say that, and I do still think that. So the state of the evidence around social media writ large in adolescent mental health is not compelling. We do not have concrete, strong effects of the amount of time that young people spend on the internet in general and social media specifically with worse adolescent mental health. So there's been a number of really robust studies, meta-analyses, the academies of science convened an expert panel on this question, and those have tended to conclude that associations with the amount of time spent on social media and worse mental health are small and not consistent. So some studies suggest that there are some effects, some studies suggest that there are not. There are some studies that show some benefits for the ways in which adolescents spend time on social media. And so the big thing there is that, like, I can't be like, yep, Instagram bad for mental health, TikTok good. That is not the state of the evidence. We can say a little bit more about certain types of engagement. Like, I know cyberbullying equals bad, but that's not the same as all of the other. There's young people engage on social media for so many different things, and it's really hard to wrap those all up into one single social media is bad for mental health coefficient.
I want to come back in a second to this TikTok thing, because there's been a lot of news about TikTok, and not so much about Instagram. To me, they're exactly the same, but I'm old. Renee, your organization, Social Light Stars, deals with social media trauma, and I'm just curious how prevalent that is as a phenomenon, trauma that results from the use of social media.
It's very prevalent. It's more prevalent than people realize, because a lot of people do not go to the authorities when they are cyberbullied or cyberstalked, which in North Carolina, cyberstalking is a crime. Anytime there is some sort of negativity that causes you to go into a state of depression and anxiety, and I'm talking about severe, to the point that you have to be diagnosed with it, you have been in a social media trauma bucket. And cyberbullying and cyberstalking is in that same bucket with social media trauma. And it can be caused on multiple platforms, just not TikTok. We're talking about Instagram, Facebook, Snapchat, any social media app that has followers or people engaging with you via the DM, which is like the messenger piece of it, or doxing you, figuring out where you live and your phone number and your email. Anytime that comes into play, that's when the social media trauma comes into play. And a lot of times that happens because people decide to go with whatever narrative that they believe. Half the time what they're seeing or reading about somebody is not even true. So it is that point of, I want to believe this narrative and I'm going to jump on this bandwagon with this person who hates this person or these people, and I'm going to find them and seek them out to bully them.
We discover social media platforms like we discover anything else that's new, and then we use them and then get bored with them and migrate, and that's happened a lot. It started with MySpace, then it moved to Facebook, and then when the parents got on Facebook, the kids moved out, and they went someplace else, and several of the places they went were TikTok and Instagram and other apps. I'm sure there are other apps that I don't even know about that kids are using today, but there is this furor over TikTok because of the influence it is having on our children. I want to hear from both of you, Renee and Michael, about, is TikTok any worse than Instagram or any other of these social media apps? I'll start with you, Renee.
I don't think there is a level of what is worse and which app is better. At the end of the day, it's the user that is using the app. And the user decides if they want to use it in a positive way or a negative way. And however they decide to use the app is what's going to go out in the atmosphere. And however long they're on the app, determines how much of the positive or negative energy they're going to get from the person that is posting whatever they're posting. Now, somebody else had asked me that same thing at a workshop. There are wonderful videos on TikTok, cooking, makeup, fashion trends, positive energy, positive influencers, as we call them, Mike. There's influencer, that influencer piece now that everybody wants to be an influencer. Mm-hmm. But But there isn't a social media app that is better or worse, in my opinion.
Well,
maybe it's all about how it is used.
Maybe using a pejorative term like better or worse is not accurate, Michaeline. Maybe we should say more influential, more impactful, or less so. Do you see a difference?
We do not have compelling evidence from the literature to suggest that TikTok is any better or worse than any of the other platforms. I will say this is a hard thing to study empirically, because by the time we as scientists get a study up and off the ground to study the new platform, kids have kind of moved on to the next one. Mm-hmm. So I will say the research tends to lag behind whatever is kind of the hot thing of the moment. But I don't think we have compelling evidence that TikTok is robustly way more harmful than anything else. I do think we tend to focus on wherever the kids are, in that people were real wound up about Instagram a couple years ago, right? The Facebook files. And I think wherever the teens are the thing that people are worked up about. There are some features of TikTok that are kind of the buzzwords right now, of the kinds of features that might be riskier or more engaging to youth that keep them on longer. So things like infinite scroll, this idea that you can just stay on there forever and it never ends. Well, like when I got on the internet.
You can do that in all these apps.
Well, that's the thing.
And if I recall correctly, and I do, when the internet first became available, this happened to me. When I first got access to the internet, I sat down on a Saturday morning in front of my computer. And the next time I looked at the clock, it was 6 o'clock. It was dark outside and I hadn't had lunch. Because I just got lost in the internet. This is what, but I survived.
Yep, you did. We're glad for it.
Thank you very much. We have to take a break. When we come back, we'll do more exploration of this phenomenon, whether it's good or bad or ugly, and how we deal with it. And I want to talk to Adam Wagner, our reporter from NC Newsroom, about the previous Surgeon General's request to put a tobacco-like warning on these apps. We'll come back and talk about that and more in just a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about social media and House Bill 301, which would regulate its use, at least within North Carolina. Adam Wagner has reported on this for NC Newsroom. That's a public radio collaborative of which WFAE is a member. Michael Lynn Jensen is an associate professor of psychology at UNC Greensboro, and Renee Thompson is executive director of Social Light Stars, which deals with social media trauma. The Surgeon General, who put out a warning in 2023 about his feelings on social media and also asked for tobacco-style warning labels, has since been replaced, as is the case with whenever new administration comes and we get a new Surgeon General. And this new administration seems to be, Adam, much less open to any kind of regulation. So where does the current Surgeon General stand on this? Do you know?
I am not sure on the federal level. I've really been focused more on the state level.
And it's really kind of interesting because this is the attorney general who put this out was a Joe Biden appointee. We haven't, I don't think, heard from the new attorney general on this topic specifically, but this bill in North Carolina is being sponsored by a Republican.
Sure. Yeah, so I think that the advisory that then Attorney General Vivek Murphy put out said that 40% of kids 8 to 12 report using social media. And that's really one of those numbers that is being cited in the as the North Carolina legislation kind of wends its way through the General Assembly. Typically, the social media platforms have a pop-up that says, are you 13 years old? Say yes or no.
Yeah.
And there's one of the arguments against the bill so far has been that kids can find their way around that. And I think that is borne out in the evidence here.
And I want to talk about that because kids are more technologically savvy than their elders in most cases. So anything you do is going to be circumvented, or that they're likely to be circumvented because they're smart about these things. The former Surgeon General, Vivek Murthy, Michael Lynn, called for those warning labels because he said that social media platforms are, quote, associated with significant mental health harm for adolescents. Do you agree with that?
I do not. I mean, I agree with him that we should be worried about adolescents' mental health. And I applaud him for that emphasis. And I think that for a long time, Surgeon General warnings were not so much focused on mental health, way more on physical health. So that piece, I think, is great. I do not think we have robust evidence that the cause of adolescents' mental health difficulties can be placed solely on the squares of social media.
And I know, Renee, you focus in your organization on trauma that results from the use of social media. And we can assume that much of that trauma comes from the negative comments that people post or say about people. And I want to talk about your personal story a little bit later on. But I know that social media facilitates or makes it very easy to say mean, nasty things about and to people, sometimes anonymously, but even if you put your name on it, you're not doing it face to face. That is where the harm comes from. It doesn't come from the platform. It doesn't come from the device. It comes from how we use it, correct?
You are absolutely correct. Social media is not bad. It is the users that determine how the level of badness, which is not a word, but it's the users that determine it. And I do want to go back to referring to mental health and social media. And I do have to say that it does affect our teens and adolescents and our children, and it even affects our adults. There's FOMO, which is fear of missing out, which causes teens and adolescents and children to want to constantly be on social media because they have a fear of missing out. There's also this sense of, I want everyone to see what I'm posting. There's a sense of likes and shares and levels of, I want to be seen, I want to be heard, that may not be.
I guess I missed that day in class, or maybe it's a generational thing. I don't understand this desire to be seen and heard beyond the confines of your own friend group. I just don't get it, and I don't understand that anybody would want to be an influencer or would pay attention to one. It seems silly to me.
Well, when you actually get paid to be an influencer,
Wait a minute. I missed that day in class too.
Yes, you did. Yes. Once you hit a certain level of followers and influence, and once you get in that algorithm, which means constantly shown when someone opens up their app, once you get to that level and the social media company sees that, then yes, you are paid to be the influencer. Yes.
So this bill, House Bill 301, proposes, Adam, to slap $50,000 fines for each time that a young teen would slip through the cracks of a social media platform and access the app if they are underage. And families of those teens would be allowed to sue the companies for up to $10,000 per violation. I'm just wondering, if this is enforceable, how will the platform even know that someone broke through who shouldn't be on it?
Yeah, so we have all kinds of age restrictions on the internet already. I mean, we've seen it in North Carolina on other adult content. I think you see it anytime you go to a website for like an alcoholic beverage, you have to affirm that you're 21. This would likely be a little bit more stringent than that. In some cases, that could look like uploading an ID or some kind of proof of age to a database. But I think there really are questions about what that mechanism would look like.
And I want to talk about that, because there are privacy concerns surrounding that part of this bill, and I'm sure it's been happening in other states. Modifications to this bill have already removed sites like news gathering organizations, sports sites, as well as entertainment sites from any prohibitions with regard to age. But it could be argued that news and sports and entertainment are all part of the TikTok, Instagram, social media ecosphere. So does this bill mention certain platforms, Adam, specifically that it is targeting, that it would require some sort of age proof to use?
It doesn't call out anyone specifically, but I think we all know what we're talking about here. I mean,
I don't.
Well, TikTok. Probably less so Facebook now. Like, it sounds like you are aware of this, that young people aren't as often on Facebook right now, but Instagram, they're not there, but I guess you could lump X in on this too.
Well, so if then you put Blue Sky and Truth in there too, because it seems to me that that's where a lot, particularly on X, that's where a lot of the vitriol is being spewed these days. But if they're not going to be specific about this, how can you impose $50,000 fines on organizations if they're not named in the bill?
It's a good question. It's a good question for the bill sponsor.
And you've already said on this program today, Adam, that most of these platforms already have minimum age requirements, which put the minimum age at about 13 for account holders, and that includes Facebook, TikTok, and YouTube. Does that lessen the impact of this bill or neuter its impact in some way? Or are there other provisions of this bill that come into play that make it more effective, more stronger in some way?
I'm not sure that it makes it less effective. I think it's just basically taking the power on that restriction away from the social media company and giving it to the state and to a Department of Justice, or even to some degree to a parent who can bring one of these claims against a company. I think there's also real questions though about what would happen to a child's data. I mean, if you uploaded it to any one of these platforms or to the third party age verification system that they use, I mean,
I want to get to, but I'm just wondering if there is an analog version of this, if there's an analog comparison. This is all in the digital realm. So is there anything comparable to legal action against an analog situation like a print publication or a store that sells print publications? Outside of pornography, I can't think of anything that would cause that organization to be fined $50,000. Anybody? Okay. Michael Lynn, I know that you have concerns over the potential efficacy of this bill. What are they?
Yeah, so I mean, I think we should be trying to help adolescents have better experiences on the internet. Like, that is a goal I think many people share. I just don't know that this bill is going to be the way to do that. I think that by setting a firm age restriction, which, as Adam alluded to, may or may not be doable in terms of feasibility, let's say they could do it. You run the risk of throwing the baby out with the bathwater, and all of the really nice, enriching, cool stuff that adolescents find on social media is also restricted from them. So yes, you're restricting their likelihood of having a cyberbullying or a cyber discrimination experience online, but you're also reducing the likelihood that they can find peers with whom they can get social support for those very types of experiences. Well, we have pretty compelling data that youth who have a hard time finding community in their offline lives, so who are marginalized in some way, who are different, find real community online and can associate with people. And that's really good for their mental health. And so I think with blanket restrictions like this, you're not restricting just the stuff that could be risky. You're also restricting the thing that could potentially be awesome and enriching for young people.
Renee, you've been nodding vigorously during all of this, and there is some indication that marginalized groups like LGBTQ plus young people, even Black people, Hispanic people, who are not part of necessarily the mainstream culture when they go to school or when they go shopping or whatever, this is a place where others like them can connect in a safe place. And that's one of the positives, is it not?
That's correct. That is a positive aspect of social media, that they have a community, that they have a place where they can speak about their experiences day to day.
Definitely. Do the positives outweigh the negatives? I want to hear from both of you on this. Renee, what do you think?
Based upon my personal experience, the negative outweighs the positive. But that's just proof within the algorithm itself that there are times that the negative videos will pop up in the algorithm before the positive. And that's a meta situation.
Not the company, just the way it works.
Yes.
Michael, what's your take on that? Do the negatives outweigh the positives, or the other way around, or are they about even?
To be honest, I think it's a really hard question to answer because each user uses the platforms in such different ways that I think it's both a question of how youth are engaging. And some of those ways might be really enriching and helping them flourish, and some of those ways could be risky. And then there's also person level characteristics. So there's some teens who arrive to the internet with some pre-existing vulnerabilities, right? So perhaps they are already struggling with mental health issues, or say body image issues is one of the places where we have more evidence that kind of social comparison and body image stuff is not so good online. So if you arrive to the internet already experiencing some of those, and then you're drawn to that type of content, for that kid, the negatives might outweigh the positives. But for another kid who arrives to the same platform with a different set of vulnerabilities, they might not be drawn to that content at all. And even if they did see it, it wouldn't be as impactful for them because they don't have that. So it's really hard to paint with one single paintbrush the experiences of all youth, because youth are super diverse.
In most recent modern times, and I'll include most of the 20th century in that, we know that young people have struggled with coming to terms with who they are, who they want to be, how they fit in with their peer group, how they deal with their parents, how they exercise a coming of age and becoming more of an independent person, not attached to mommy or daddy. And all of that has issues attached to it. And we do know that young people of that age are more prone to depression and anxiety because of it. And I'm just curious, is this just an amplifier? Is social media, the use of it, simply an amplifier? It's not necessarily causing it. I guess it could. But is it causing it any more frequently than what's happening in the real world?
Yeah, so I think you're exactly right. And I wouldn't even say just the 20th century. Adolescence is evolutionarily, since the dawn of time, the part of our human life course where people are attuned to their peer group more than they have ever been. It's the time when they are evolutionarily supposed to distance themselves a bit from their parents, affiliate more with potential romantic partners and with friends and with a new community, and to establish their identity. That's actually really normal and not remotely pathological. That's normal. Social media, in some ways, is an excellent fit for the tasks of adolescence. It enables adolescents to express themselves in ways, to try on different hats, different identities, experiment with like, what are they into and who could they be and who could they affiliate with in a way that is a wider circle than you get face to face. So I think you're exactly right. It might amplify what was already happening in adolescence.
And ideally, a social media puts a wall between you and any potential physical danger that you might experience in interacting with people that you don't know as you expand your horizons and your peer group. But it does cause a problem because of what we talked about a little bit, Renee, already, and that is some of the comments that come across the various platforms. And I know that you are a social media trauma survivor, your words. And you came to this as an adult, correct?
Correct. From a family member. So there was a family member that posted a situation that happened in my home. And it was a mistake that I had made that was supposed to stay between family. And because she felt like I didn't receive the consequence that I should have received, she decided to post it on Facebook in 2001. And because of that, I started Socialize Stars, the nonprofit movement. And she found out about the nonprofit movement in 2000, after I post, after everything happened. She was made aware about the nonprofit movement and she was upset about that. So she took the same situation that happened in 2021, and posted it on TikTok in 2024, which amplified everything to 10,000, because we know, again, you mentioned TikTok. So you know that TikTok's level of influence is way higher than Facebook.
So you came to this as an adult with probably a larger toolkit than a young person might have in terms of understanding how to deal with this, although I'm sure it was hurtful and something you didn't need in your life. But when we come back, I want to know what you learned from this that could perhaps be passed on to those who are struggling with something similar in their own use of social media. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Our New South. This Charlotte-based Levine Museum podcast explores today's South through social, political, and cultural topics in their historical context, featuring conversations with locals driving change. Our New South is available on all podcast platforms.
The Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about House Bill 301, which would restrict the use of social media to children below the age of 13. It would restrict them from using it below the age of 13 and impose fines if they were somehow to be able to slip through the cracks. We're talking about it with Adam Wagner, who is a reporter for NC Newsroom, a reporting collaborative of public radio stations, including WFAE. Michael N. Jensen is an associate professor of psychology at UNC Greensboro, and Renee Thompson is executive director of Social Light Stars, which was founded to deal with cyberbullying, which we were talking about just before the break. You were a victim of it, Renee, and I'm curious what you learned from that experience and from a survivor's point of view. What is the best way to deal with cyberbullies?
The best way to deal with cyberbullies is to not respond to them and to block and delete them. And also because it was my second time going through cyberbullying in 2024, I was able to take my information to the DA's office, and my family member was charged with cyber stalking. And I was one of the first cases in Mecklenburg County that actually went through and had a trial, and the DA was actually able to prosecute someone for cyber stalking based upon the screenshots I had of her followers sending me emails and sending me nasty text messages. Mm-hmm. Also, we were able to screen record her live on TikTok, and we were able to see that she would pin my Instagram handle to the top, which the judge determined that would be considered cyber stalking, because that's considered doxing someone.
And you were dealing with this as an adult, and I'm sure the same thing happens with young people who don't have the tools, don't even have the awareness that perhaps this is a crime, don't have the awareness that they might be able to get help from a parent or a teacher or even an older sibling about this. And young people historically have been very mean to each other, live and in person, not just on social media. Michael, is cyberbullying somehow more powerful, more destructive than what might happen on the playground or in the halls at school?
So any type of victimization has the risk for being really harmful. The thing about social media is that it can be more pervasive. So it doesn't end when you hop on the bus to go home. They can come at any hour of the day and at any physical location. And the reach is wide. So it has the potential to be spread far beyond your playground network, for instance. So those risks are substantial. But I will highlight that a lot of actually online victimization experiences overlap with offline networks. So even Renee's example, unfortunately, sometimes victimization comes from people who we also know in our offline lives.
Yeah. And Renee, you conduct workshops, I know, for parents and for young people. And you did them, you've done them through CMS in after school programs and with parents. And you've stressed setting digital boundaries. And you've delved into the concept of something called digital wellness. Explain what you see as the digital boundaries.
Digital boundaries and digital wellness means that we need to have a healthy relationship with our digital devices. We need to set screen time limits. We need to set more in-person conversations with people. We need to set times with just to ourselves, bringing out the old school board games, the word searches, realizing that there is more to life than our digital device, making sure that it's...
What about talking about what is appropriate and what is inappropriate to say on a device or on a platform? Is it similar to what you would or would not say to somebody in person?
Absolutely. If you wouldn't say you need to kill yourself to that person when you're face to face with them, you should not be telling them that on a digital device or on a digital platform in the comment section.
Are we teaching digital literacy? I don't think we're teaching civics very well anymore, clearly. I don't think that we are teaching, just personal interaction very well. But Michaelyn, are we teaching digital literacy? And shouldn't we be?
I definitely think we should be. And I think you're getting at this idea that there are certainly skills that we could equip our youth and adults with to help them navigate digital spaces successfully. So this is often referred to as digital literacy. You're also getting at an idea of what's sometimes called digital citizenship. So it's not just that you're like know how to get online and navigate those spaces, but you're a productive, kind, thoughtful member of those communities. And I definitely think we should be instilling those skills in kids. I don't think we do so systematically in our
country. And part of that is also dealing with what you read online, because everybody picks up their phone and they read a headline or they read a short paragraph of a story and they think, well, it's on the internet, so it must be true. And it's not. You have to consider the source. That particularly is true when it comes to news. And that's what's responsible for a lot of this myths and disinformation floating around. Adam, I know you wanted to jump in here.
Yeah, so the digital literacy piece is something that came up during one of the debates. This bill has kind of moved through the committees. And it was basically that if you're going to have this ban and kind of stick-oriented approach, then maybe the carrot is some kind of digital literacy, a course or a requirement. Because again, working under the assumption that kids are going to get around these bans somehow, it's going to happen. So then how do you make sure, or at least give them the tools to try to be safe online?
Many of these platforms, as we have said, have already set their own age floor of 13 to have an account, and this bill would require that be the case for these digital platforms that go unnamed. Michaelyn, why is 13 the magic age? Why not 15? Why not 27?
It's a great question. So, and it is a little different. So the current age is you can have a profile at 13, and the bill would make it 14 with parental consent. So it's 1 year different. I think that 13 is often appealing as a number because it's has the word teen in it, frankly. And we think of adolescence as like, oh, some maturity that inherently comes along with that. I think we afford teens more autonomy and more ability to navigate spaces independently, but I actually don't think there's anything magic about being 13. Some 13-year-olds are really ready to be doing a lot of things independently and some are not.
So as we have alluded to, teenagers are usually more technologically savvy than their elders. And I was going to ask if these kids would be able to find a workaround to these restrictions that this bill proposes. But this bill, in fact, calls for third-party verification methods to make sure that these restrictions cannot be circumvented or be very difficult to circumvent. And that caught the attention of Wilmington Democrat Deb Butler, who raised concerns about how a would-be user's age would be verified and how parental consent would be gathered by saying this is going to be a little more difficult to implement than I think we can even begin to recognize. Adam, how does this bill suggest this third-party verification work?
There's not a lot of specifics in here.
I have to stop you. Is that normal for a bill at this stage of the game?
It just depends on the topic. I mean, yes and no.
Or is it illustrative of a generation that doesn't really understand this, but they want to do something about it?
I'm not going to say that. But I think that the other concern that came up in the committee that I found kind of interesting was the freedom of speech item. And basically, the idea that social media is our modern equivalent of the public square, and that kids have First Amendment rights too. So if you cut off their access to the public square, you're violating their First Amendment rights. We're seeing kind of a test case on this in Ohio right now, where their ban, similar to North Carolina's, has been stayed by a federal judge. I don't know if a similar lawsuit be brought in North Carolina, should this law pass?
And to be clear, parents have a right to restrict the free speech rights of their children. They don't have to give them access to these devices. They don't have to give them access to these platforms. But you bring up this free speech. The government can't do it. And Rayla Collins, who is no relation to me, but with the ACLU in North Carolina, believes that this bill could, in fact, undermine both child safety and violate a teen's constitutional rights.
The internet is our nation's primary marketplace of ideas, and social media's primary purpose is to allow users to speak.
Is this debate going through the General Assembly at the moment over this bill? Adam?
Certainly part of the conversation around this. I mean, it seems to be... It's an interesting critique of this legislation, especially considering the active lawsuit in federal courts.
Michael Lynn.
I think it's an interesting argument. And I would also just highlight that since they haven't worked out the logistics of how the verification of age will happen, adults will also have to submit their information to be verified to prove that you're not an adult. And so that means that any adult who doesn't have the digital literacy or the right documentation to gain access, their free speech would also be restricted. So this actually doesn't only impact the teens who are too young. It's any adult who can't pass that gate, which is yet to be determined of how that will work. And I think that's a substantial risk.
Which gets us into the topic of privacy concerns. We already give away a lot of personal information to various online entities. Just our mere presence on the internet is giving tons of information to these people for free that they're using for us and against us. Proving a person's age is just another piece of that puzzle. And if you're going to tell somebody on the internet that your child is of age, 13, they now have a benchmark. They know how old your child is when they're 17 or 20 or 50. They're keeping track of all this. Are there protections in this or any other piece of legislation out there against this data farming, particularly for young people? Does anybody know of anything? Adam, is it mentioned in this bill?
There's some limitations in the bill based on how the data is supposed to be used, I think social media companies have earned a healthy amount of skepticism based on how they've used our data in the past.
Well, this bill requires this third-party age verification service to destroy personal identifying information once the age has been confirmed, and to keep that information anonymous and protect it with reasonable security practices. That's a quote from the bill. Should we have any reason to believe that any of that will happen?
I think that's just a, we have to see how it plays out.
When it comes, go ahead, Michaelyn.
I was just going to say, I mean, I don't know about you all, but I get emails a couple times a year about ways in which my data has been compromised from many institutions who purportedly have those same types of protections. And so I just think it's something we should be cautious about.
So when it comes to requiring this third-party identification or verification of a child's age, one presumes it would have to come from a parent or from a guardian. And as you alluded to a minute ago, Michaelyn, this may cause some people to not want to do this at all. NetChoice, a trade association that advocates for companies like TikTok and Meta, the parent company of Facebook, says that age verification requirements can have a chilling effect on adults who might not want to share their personal information when setting up an account. The attorney for that group told NPR that by doing ID for the internet, which is essentially what we're talking about here, you're telling everyone, regardless of age, you could be 66, you could be 15, that you may not speak, you may not access content unless you turn over massive amounts of information. That's from the industry's point of view. Is that point of view shared by any substantial number of consumers? Is this fear floating around out there in any meaningful way?
I think there are a fair number of consumers that share that fear. I'd also note that the federal judge in Ohio called that legislation, again, similar to North Carolina's, a, quote, breathtakingly blunt instrument, end quote. So he seems to share some of those fears as well.
I mean, in North Carolina, you have to be a certain age to access pornographic websites. They have blocked, most pornographic websites have blocked people who live in North Carolina based on their IP address. So has the precedent been set for this already?
Adam? I think that is the argument the bill sponsors would make, that we do this for those websites so the technology is available. And we can do it. Now, is that a like-for-like comparison? I'm not sure.
So there are at least 5 states, I believe, that have done this already. 9 are in the pipeline, including North Carolina. Texas and Florida have put some restrictions on social media usages for teens. Do we have any information, Michaelyn, about how effective or ineffective these restrictions have been in those states?
I think the jury's still out on that. They haven't been in place long enough. I think researchers are actively trying to understand this. It's something of a natural experiment where we can know, especially people who had collected data from before the restrictions and after. If we see a bump in adolescent mental health, I would find that compelling. But it's an empirical question, and we don't have that data yet.
And you've said this is not going to be a quick fix. It's going to require a lot of legislation that does things like ask platforms to deplatform things like hate speech. And that could be in itself a violation of free speech, I suppose. Adam, this current bill is in committee. Is it likely to get to the floor of the House? Is it likely to go to the Senate in this session? Is it likely to be passed?
It is still moving as we speak. It seems to have momentum. A lot of lawmakers, again, from both sides of the aisle, are speaking in favor of it. So my read right now would be that it is at least likely to clear the House. Yes.
So it does have a certain level of bipartisan support. If it clears the House, if it makes it through the Senate, if it gets sent to the governor, would he likely sign it? And if he didn't sign it, would there be votes to override that veto, or do you know?
I am not sure. Again, based on... So who knows what happens when things get sent over to the Senate?
Right.
And yeah, there's a lot of support in the House right now, though.
So we'll have to keep our eye on it in the months ahead because we're just in the early stages of this. Adam Wagner's a reporter for NC Newsroom. Renee Thompson, executive director of Social Light Stars, which deals with internet trauma or social media trauma. And Michaelyn Jensen, associate professor of psychology at UNC Greensboro, who focuses on this in her research. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. We have additional production help from Jesse Steinmetz. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.